questions.
Our first question comes from Dan. How many songs of a particular band or artist do you have to like in order to call yourself a fan?
That's an interesting one.
Because I think double figures.
Okay.
Although, to be honest, if you like 10 songs by anybody, that's a lot.
But that's an album.
Yeah.
So it's not a lot. If you like an album, I mean, there's a Paul Simon album, which you would like all the tracks on. 10 songs is one album.
Okay, so how many songs of a particular band or artist do you have to like before you call yourself a fan?
I would say that in order to be a fan, you have to like them beyond them. So an example for me would be the Concert Angels recorded 3 albums at Polydor, which are generally regarded by the music press to be really seminal works.
The music press, remind me, what's that?
Yeah. In the days when the New Musical Express was something with which you could hit somebody. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are 3 Concert Angels albums, which is Waiting for a Miracle, Sleep No More, and Fiction. And then they left Polydor and they went to Jive and they did Land and 7 Day Weekend. And I think that the fan bit is that you carry on after the moment that the establishment think, okay, those are the great ones. And another good example would be if you're somebody who's stuck with, like, you know, Yachts, their first album was very well received. Yachts Without Radar, less so. But I loved them all the way through. So I think the essence of being the fan is that you stay with them.
Yeah, but what's the answer to the question?
Well, I'm...
How many songs? Are you saying...
I'm answering the question.
Go on then. How many?
I'm answering the question by saying I don't think it's a matter of how many songs. I think it's the essence of being a fan is that you carry on loving them when that train has left the station for everyone else. So, you know, it's like, are you a Dexys Midnight Runners fan? Yeah, fine, yes. Did you like Kevin Rowland's My Beauty? I mean, were you one of the people that bought The Wanderer? That would be the fan is that you go with them after everyone else has left them. That's what a fan is.
Hmm.
Don't you think? Isn't that a good description of a fan?
I think you could. I'm a fan of 70s Quo. I'm putting limits on my fandom.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think you can't do that.
I've just done it. I am a fan of 70s Quo.
No, you have just done it. But I think, therefore, the fact that you qualified it means that you're not a Quo fan, okay? Why aren't you a Quo fan? Because you're a fan of 70s Quo. So that's not, you are not a Quo fan.
I still think if you've got on your phone or if you've got in your record collection more than one record by an artist or a band, that kind of counts. You're not an Uber fan the way Mark is, no, but you're still a fan.
But okay. Without putting the qualification on it, are you a status quo fan?
I'm a 70s quo
no,
fan.
No, precisely.
So you didn't answer my question, so I'm answering your question.
No, I am answering your question. The answer to the question is no, you are a 70s quo fan. That means you're not a fan. It means you're somebody who loves the stuff they did in the 70s.
Anyway. Okay.
Well, to be like that, I'm giving a practical answer. A practical answer is that in order to be a fan, you have to be somebody who sticks with them when other people have moved on.
Sophie in South London, I recently heard filmmaker and abyss gazer Werner Herzog on the New Yorker podcast, which is called Radio Hour. On this, he stated that he would rather be dead than go to therapy. His view was that people should, at most, talk to partners or people who have gone through similar experiences, but ultimately move on. To paraphrase, deal with your soul and get over it.
Yeah.
I know Mark is currently reading Herzog's book, which is called Every Man for Himself
and God Against All.
And both of you have previously endorsed the benefits of professional insight, so I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts. Should I risk the wrath of Herzog and finally get some therapy?
Well, I did an interview with Herzog just a couple of weeks ago about the book. And of course, he says a lot of very provocative things in the book. You know, the thing about, you know, the culture of complaint disgusts me. The whole of the 20th century was a mistake. He's given to these great proclamations. And he says that he thinks that psychotherapy is one of the worst things that ever happened in the history of, you know. And I disagree completely. But the fact is that Herzog says a lot of things that they sound good in the room. And they have, I understand why, but I don't agree with them. I mean, I absolutely don't agree with him about therapy, but I understand what his point of view is, and I find him entertaining, but I don't agree with him.
It would be the very worst reason to not have therapy because
Werner Herzog told you not to, yeah. And also, if you see the world the way Werner Herzog does, then therapy would be a bad thing, but most people aren't Werner Herzog. And I think the answer to your question is, should I have therapy? Well, question, are you Werner Herzog? If the answer is yes, then no. If the answer is no, then maybe.
So, Sophie, I think that's a very good answer. Here's an interesting question from Harriet in Austin.
Yeah.
What idiosyncrasies drive you crazy about your significant, respective, her indoors? Or hers indoors?
Drive you crazy in a...
This is all I have. So what idiosyncrasies drive you crazy about your significant, respective, her indoors? So I will go first.
Okay.
We live in different time zones. This is a mutual inconsistency, meaning I wake up first. I go to bed first.
Because you were up this morning at like 4:30.
Yeah, but I'm like 90 minutes ahead. So okay. It's like I will, if we're going to a thing, I'll want to go first and also want to leave it first. So I'm just permanently ahead. I'm like 90 minutes ahead at the worst, just constantly there. And she's always, so from her point of view, yeah. I'm always ridiculously ahead. And from my point of view, she's always ridiculously behind. This is enhanced by the clock change, which has really done my sleep in. But anyway, so I think it's like I live in a different time zone. That's an idiosyncrasy. Because it's not like an annoying habit. So an idiosyncrasy is quite an interesting way of explaining it. So what are you going to pitch in?
The only thing that springs to mind, because the idiosyncrasy is, as you say, the key word in that sentence. And when you say crazy, do you mean drives you crazy as in you get annoyed, or drives you crazy as, I mean, you know, everybody does things idiosyncratically. Like one of the things that the good lady Professor Her indoors will do is she will decide completely, suddenly out of nowhere that a wall needs redecorating now.
Okay, well, that'll do. Yeah,
but the thing I was going to say, so that is like, it's, you know, oh, the door on that thing is hanging. No, we have to, that has to be fixed now. Your relative is coming to visit. We must repaint the room. Why? Okay. You go, no, because they're fine. But the other thing that the good lady Professor Hurry does, it's this kind of stopped happening reason, because you know that I did the whole thing about, you know, I lost some weight. And one of the ways I did that was I stopped drinking beer. Because, you know, who knew? Turns out.
Yeah, amazing.
Fine. And I like a pub and the good lady doesn't. She likes a cafe. You know, she likes a cafe with tea and, you know, and I like a pub. But which she will often say, look, you know, if you'd like to get something that you'd like to do, go to the, you know, we go to the pub. But the thing she'll do is, if you've got a, you know, like a pint, you know, and I don't, and this has happened less recently because don't drink pints, but you'd be sitting there with a pint, it would be like, you know, half full. And she'd get up to leave and you'd go, and she'd go, oh. And then sit. And then it's like, okay, well now, you know. Under sufferance. It's that thing about, but you
it's half a pint. I can't hurry.
I can't hurry the pint. And it'd be a weird thing. I go, did you not see that? She went, no, I didn't know. No, it's fine. And then she'd go, take your time, which is literally like you can't possibly take your time.
Goes on phone.
That's right.
Writes email.
Because it's like everything about it.
I think they're idiots.
They're idiosyncrasies.
Okay. Correspondence.
I tell you, the biggest idiosyncrasy is that she married me.
Very good. Correspondence at kermanandmerrin.com is where you send this stuff to. Arthur Newman says, oh no.
Arthur Newman says, oh no.
Anyway, who's this from? This is Eric the Half a Bee.
Aha. Ha ha ha. He he he.
There's a film. Is there a film called Arthur Newman? Anyway, character played by Colin Firth. Anyway, this is the thing. It's about age gaps.
Okay.
With regard to your continuing efforts to undermine the Hydra-like grip of the patriarchy in Hollywood, what are the most egregious age gaps between romantic couples in cinema, where the man is significantly older than the woman in such a way as to be borderline creepy, excluding films where the inappropriate age gap is the point of the film. So not Lolita or An Education. So here's the suggestions from Eric. Arthur Newman, Colin Firth, 52, Emily Blunt, 29. Magic in the Moonlight, Colin Firth, 54, Emma Stone, 26. Okay, so we're serial offender. As Good as It Gets, Jack Nicholson, who's 60, Helen Hunt, 34. That is ridiculous. Although it's a good film. Manhattan, Woody Allen, 44, Meryl Hemingway, 18.
Although that is a subject of the film.
Okay. When Harry Met Sally, Billy Crystal is 41 and it shows Meg Ryan is 28. I think
that doesn't count because they're meant to be the same age.
Yeah,
because they start young at college and then they're meant to be the same age.
Okay.
Because during the course of When Harry Met Sally, they both age. So one of them is aging down and the other is aging up. But I think in terms of, it had never occurred to me that in real life that gap was, but it's not portrayed as an older man and a younger woman. They're meant to be contemporaneous ages, yeah. aren't they?
Yes. Anyway, okay.
Yeah.
This is all what Eric thinks. Who signs off up with women not being told they're no longer after 40, down with men who think having a younger female partner makes them look cool. Eric, thank you. Any other particularly inappropriate?
There's a joke.
I mean, there's loads of them back in the day. Less so now.
There is a joke is it in When Harry Met Sally or is it in when the thing about that Billy Crystal's character is with somebody who's younger than him, and he says, "Yeah, I said, you know, where were you when Kennedy was shot?" And they said somebody shot, but then it was a later Kennedy. I'm blowing this joke completely. The thing is, that Sean Connery in almost everything in the sort of late period was a serial offender.
Yeah,
but it's really hard to pick the most egregious because it's like when you're swimming in warm water, you don't feel the warm water anymore. It just feels like it's just everywhere. You know, it became such a trope that people
I would like to chip in for different reasons. Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster.
Oh yeah, but that is absolutely
come
absurd.
On.
Yes, what's the Ralph Fiennes thing in which somebody of a contemporaneous age plays his mother? That happened. There's somebody, yeah, because I know that, you know, the women said the thing about, you know, you go from playing the girlfriend to playing the mother in a course of 3 years. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to pick a specific example because there are just too many.
Tammy. Sends in this question. What's the strangest fact you know that most people don't? What is the strangest fact you know that most people don't? The one that sprang to mind, as I do believe I've mentioned this before, but that, because I'm a fan of etymology and looking words up and stuff like that, yeah. Hocus pocus, as, you know, said by magicians or, you know, characterizations of magicians over the years, is derived from, it's basically a Mickey take of the mass. The first line of mass, here is the body, hoc est corpus in Latin. And hocus pocus
is from
hoc est corpus. So the whole hocus pocus thing is an anti-Catholic, well, anti-religion joke about the mass. There you go.
I didn't know that. Well, the things I would say are,
what is the strangest fact you know that most people don't, of course, by in the act of telling us.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that leaps to mind, although actually maybe most people do this, is that an orange is a norange.
Yes. And the N has moved
because it's naranja. And it is literally a norange, not an orange. All My Eye and Peggy Martin was the thing that I knew, which is a bit.
What's that?
All My Eye and Peggy Martin.
What is that?
Well, it's a phrase that my mother used to use quite a lot. And what it means is...
In what context?
Well, let me explain. So if you were explaining something to her that was kind of, that she didn't understand, she said, oh, it's all My Eye and Peggy Martin, meaning it's all mumbo jumbo. It's all gibberish, hocus pocus. And it is a mishearing of a song from foreign climes that has been translated into... It's like, I believe Elephant and Castle is L'Enfant de Castile. You know that? Is it not true?
The redactor.
Okay, the redactor said that's not true. So that's fine. So that but that isn't true. Yeah, is that correct that it isn't? Why is it Elephant and Castle in that case? Remember, look. Oh, fine. So that's a what you call it? You know, it's like backronyming. But All My Eye and Peggy Martin is a phrase that used to be used to mean it's all stuff and I don't understand what you're saying. And it is apparently an English hearing of a song in a foreign tongue sung by sailors. I believe that that's the case.
Okay.
The other one is, well, a lot of people probably do know this, but it's not strange. Cinema doors open outwards because of the great history of fire.
Yes.
Oh, I know. Here's the thing. Do you know why councils are responsible for the censorship of films?
I think you have told me, but it's, you know, dripped away.
It's to do with fire. It's to do with fire regulations. Films were considered dangerous because film was flammable, nitrate film was particularly flammable. Mm-hmm. And so cinema doors open outwards because there were terrible, terrible cinema fires in the early days in which people got trapped in cinema. So all cinema doors inside are meant to open outwards. And the power for councils to regulate what can and cannot be shown in cinemas did not come from handing the councils, you know, like when the GLC would be able to overturn the BBFCX, that the GLC would be able to say, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the BBFC didn't certificate it, but the GLC gave it a certificate. So you could appeal to individual councils. So like the council at Truro banned The Life of Brian, for example. The reason councils had that power was nothing to do with censorship of what was on the film. It was to do with power over the film, because film itself was a flammable medium. So the reason that councils have censorship power is because of fire risk.
Do they still have that power?
Well, technically, they did during the time of Crash, because Westminster Council banned Crash and never unbanned it. Of course, nowadays, it's almost unheard of. And I can't think if there's been a case since Westminster Council banning Crash. I do know that Westminster Council never lifted the ban on Crash, so it is technically still banned in Westminster cinemas. And I do know that I presented the first screening in Truro of Life of Brian after the ban.
Mike Rudd in Deepest But Not Darkest Somerset. It's that time of year when ITV starts showing the Harry Potter films. Okay, we've already touched on this. I noticed that as the films progress, they get darker, not only in tone and content, but also in your ability to see what's happening on the screen. Following the review of No One Will Save You, I thought I'd save that for a Friday evening as the nights draw in to watch it at home. It starts off well, but as soon as you hit the night scenes, you might as well be listening to the soundtrack album for all you can see on the screen. The occasional flashes of grey punctuated by the heroine's gasps are all I could get, even with the lights off and the curtains closed. In the end, I gave up, frustrated at not being able to follow. My questions are these. Have you ever had to abandon a film as it was so difficult to follow? Why do filmmakers insist on making things so dark you can't see what is in the end a visual medium? Don't get me started on mumbling. Out with some things and down with others. Mike Rudd. So it is true that, and I can't think of a specific example, that a film that you might be able to follow in the cinema under perfect viewing conditions, mm-hmm. then when it's on the television, what?
Yeah, that is a not uncommon experience. And occasionally I have been sent screener links for things in which it's just like, I'm sorry, I can't see anything.
Yes.
So yes, it is definitely true that, I remember when Sir Sevenon came out on DVD, there was like a featurette in which David Fincher was talking about the fact that only on a home viewing medium was he able to guarantee that the blacks were as black as he wanted them to be. If you remember, there was a certain number of prints of Sir Sevenon which had silver nitrate retention, which meant that the blacks were very black and the brights were very bright and the contrast was very, but apparently there weren't that many prints of it. So if you went to see it in a cinema, you might get a good print, but you might get a fudgy print. But when you got it on DVD, it was color corrected, you know, to within an inch of its life, but you're watching it in a room with the light on.
You would have been intrigued by, I went to see, when we went to Florence a couple of weeks ago, and we went to see an exhibition by Anish Kapoor, because it was very near where we were staying. And Anish Kapoor has developed, I think quite controversially, he owns the copyright of A Shade of Black that is so dark, which emits no light at all, which is absolutely extraordinary. So that, for example...
I'm astonished that such a thing exists.
Yes. So he has painted... Under these conditions, if you see a black circle on the wall painted, like a large black circle, you know, with a circumference of a meter, say, mm-hmm. and you're standing you're standing a meter away from it, you would not be able to tell whether it's a flat circle
or a hole
or whether it's concave.
Oh. And did you see this? You
yes. Vanta Black, is that what it's called? Okay, so, and then another example, you're standing...
And does it work?
It's absolutely extraordinary and very disconcerting. You're standing in front of, so another big black circle, maybe the size of, you know, two footballs, that kind of thing. And you're looking at it and you're staring at it, you can see nothing unusual about it. When you walk around to the side, you realize that there's a black tennis ball stuck on in front of it. So it's actually...
You can't see.
You cannot, from the front, you cannot see it. From the side... You absolutely can.
Firstly, I need this in my life. I need to see this now. What's it called? Vanta Black.
Yeah, Anish Kapoor has the rights to it. It's a bit quite controversial because people said you can't own a color, but guess
apparently
what?
Apparently he does, can.
And it is the most disconcerting thing because you cannot, and obviously you can't reach out and touch it.
Yeah.
But you just want to do that because is that like 3 feet deep or is that completely surface?
Okay, that sounds astonishing, and I want to see it. Can I just read you this because I've just looked this up? Okay, so I googled All My Own Peggy Martin. What I get is All My Own Betty Martin. My mum definitely said Peggy Martin. It says, etymology. In Britain during the 1700s, the phrase was a common claim of dismissal, similar to nonsense or hogwash, or a way to declare disbelief of an absurdity. It possibly, and that's why I said anything, possibly originated as the punchline of a joke, though this is likely a folk etymology. Most variations of the joke involve a British sailor visiting Italy. He overhears a Latin prayer, A di mihi bete Martin, which translates, "Ah, grant to me, blessed Martin," referring to St. Martin or St. Martin, and he hears it as All My Own Betty Martin. So the version of that I've heard is that it's a song in prayer that is sung by sailors, you know, blah, 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 like for those in peril on the sea. But it is pretty certainly a British mistranslation of a foreign phrase. And the phrase my mother used was All My Eye and Peggy Martin.
I believe this is what used to be referred to as Chinese whispers, to which then your children would say, you can't say that anymore. I go, okay, that's fine.
Why was it called that?
Well, it's like a game where you put...
No, I remember, but why was it called Chinese whispers? Did that game originate in China?
I don't know. Maybe it was... the assumption was that if someone who speaks naturally in a different language says something, you don't actually hear it properly.
No, but wasn't the point about Chinese whispers that it was like
meaning changes from beginning to the end.
You whisper something in somebody's ear, and then they whisper it to the next person, and during the course of whispering, it comes back as something different.
It does.
Yeah, fine.
That's what I was meaning. Yeah. Simon Milner, this is about you and pizza again.
Okay.
Long-term listener, second-time emergency mailer, having moved from London to Singapore, got divorced and remarried to a colonial commoner. Australian Natalie, whose parents hail from Scandinavian Holland, since my last email.
Okay.
Simon, you've been very, very busy. I can't be alone in being fascinated by how Mark eats his pizza, not least since it's the opposite of how I eat mine. So just remind for people who don't remember.
Okay,
so what you do is you
eat all the way round... I eat all the way round the crust first, turning the plate, you know, every time, so that at the end of it, you have a pizza which has, it's just pure pleasure. The crust has gone. You've done the...
It's a very revealing answer, wasn't it, I think. Are there any other dishes or cuisines that Mark or Simon, count me out of it, takes the same approach? All the chips before the fish or burger, the seaweed before the sushi, the refried beans before the taco, the mash before the bangers? And the schmeschen is, what does eating the crust before the toppings tell us about Mark's general predilections? In a good film, mediocre film, double bill, would he watch the mediocre one first? Anyway, so we've moved off. Anyway, I think... Are there any other dishes other than pizza where you have an absolutely set routine in which you will eat things in a different order?
I think I probably do eat most food in, if it's a food that I have eaten regularly, I eat it in exactly the same order every single time.
Which would be, so say we give you fish fingers, chips and peas.
Yeah, no, a better example would be, because I eat fish, you know, I'm pescatarian, so if I get sushi... So there's the whole thing about how do you do the sushi. So sushi, when it comes, if you go to a popular sushi chain, comes with, in one particular way, there's a sashimi, and then you get the green stuff, and then you get the end game beans, as I like to refer to them, and then the thing. So, but what I have to do is I get two of them. I take the green stuff out because it's messy. I eat individually each one of the end game beans, which you have to do them with chopsticks. And you have to eat them, and then you have one box. You've got two boxes. You eat the one box. You get the little thing that's got the
okay.
So
there is a set order in which you
absolutely set order, and it looks. And the other one is that if I have there's a cafe that I go to that does a very nice veggie breakfast, and I get two cups of tea at the same time. So I get the vegetarian breakfast, the two cups of tea, and I go over to sit myself down. I put one cup of tea on the saucer, and then I take the saucer from the other cup of tea and I put it on top so that it keeps it warm. I then drink the first cup of tea. I move all the toast to the side of the plate.
It's incredible.
I move all the toast to the side of the plate, and then I use the saucer that's underneath the cup, which is that by then warm. I put the toast on that, and it keeps the toast warm. I take one piece of toast off and put it under the thing, and I do it literally exactly the same way every time. And I am aware whilst I'm doing it that I must look completely mad, because I've sort of got a kind of balancing act happening on the table. But in that cafe, they just look at me like, oh, it's just him.
Was it in the...
You know, it's funny. Now that I say it out loud, it sounds stranger than it seems.
It does. It does sound very strange. In the Alan Turing film...
Yes.
When he... Whoever plays Alan Turing at school, when he is at school, he goes to private school, which is obviously comes over as some kind of nightmare.
Yeah.
And he's given his food. He insists... He has... a bit of a turn because his food is touched. All the different food types are touching right. each other, and he wants his food separated. That nothing,
yes, nothing can touch.
But that's nothing can touch.
But
anything.
Many kids have that, yeah. You know, because obsessive compulsive things happen.
Do you think that what you've just is that obsessive compulsive?
Yes, and I think it's not uncommon among young children. You know that you can't have. You can't have things on the plate touching each other. I mean, I'm sure that there are many people listening who have experienced that. Either they've experienced it themselves, or they have experienced it with their children or with their children's friends. You know, the peas can't touch the thing, and then most of the time you just get over it. But some things they just say. I mean, I am obsessive compulsive. I always have been. I used to do the thing about turning a tap off, putting my hand underneath it to make sure it's turned off. And I still have to do that thing about putting my hand underneath it to make sure it's turned off. I used to, when I was younger, do that thing about if you bang yourself on one side, you have to bang yourself on the other side, and they have to equal up. You have to do the same amount of steps on your right foot as the same amount of steps on your left foot. If you bang the inside of your foot, you have to do the thing.
It's exhausting.
It is exhausting. And what usually happens is that you just get tired and you stop doing it. But I still have all the residual, and I still do the drawing, the thing in the air. That's fine. But that, I think that is just, I don't think it's that uncommon, is it?
I am not equipped to answer, but I don't do any of those things.
But the thing is, I don't know what the world would be like if you didn't do that. So it doesn't seem odd to me, because it's just...
I gave you a slice of pizza now to eat with your fingers, you would just eat it.
I would starve.
But you'd just eat it, wouldn't you?
You mean if it was cut already?
Yeah, I just handed you a slice of pizza.
Yes, it isn't that I couldn't say I can't eat a slice of pizza because I can't do the way around. No, it wouldn't be that.
No.
But, yeah.
Finally, final question from Jemima in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
What's a book you love that most people have never heard of?
Ooh. Well, have most people... Do you know Blow Your House Down by Pat Barker?
I know who Pat Barker is. Okay, interviewed Pat Barker, but I haven't read that book.
Well, in that case, I will go for that, because since it's a famous enough author, because obviously she, you know, very, very celebrated. It's an early Pat. So I think it's after Union Street. I think Union Street is before it. And I think it is an absolute masterpiece, but I am shocked at how many people haven't read it or haven't even heard of it.
Yeah. And it's difficult to know whether people have heard of something or not, but I would contribute My Name is Asher Lev by Chaim Potok.
Oh, well, I don't know that at all.
I thought it was just it had been recommended to me by a number of people. And it's about a Jewish boy growing up in a very, very ultra-Orthodox family who has an incredible skill for painting. But what he wants to do is to paint Christian imagery.
Right.
And that it does not go down well. So it's sort of a conversation about art and extreme religion, really. That's what it is. But okay. It's written in a very, very intense way, but it's just incredible.
Wow.
So there you go. But you haven't heard of it. So that counts.
There we go. So we both came up with choices that were...
I think it worked. I think, yes. It worked. So we've come up with a couple of decent answers.
It's all my eye on Peggy Martin.
Yeah. Well, if you have a fantastically short question for us, because they usually provoke the best answers, please send it to correspondence@kerbenandmayo.com. And also, if you'd like to chip in with other answers to other stuff that we've been discussing, if we've got it hopelessly wrong or have revealed something that you think is unpleasant, do get in touch. correspondence@kerbenandmayo.com. And don't forget, take one and take two with you on Friday.